independently of its targets. Only when we become aware of it does it wrap itself in identifiable colors. More often, we repress it, bury it under ideas, identifications, deeds, beliefs, and relationships. We build above it a mound of activities and attributes that we mistake for our true selves. We then expend our energies trying to convince the world that our self-made fiction is reality. As genuine as our strengths and achievements may be, they cannot but feel hollow until we acknowledge the anxiety they cover up. Incompleteness is the baseline state of the addict. The addict believes, either with full awareness or unconsciously, that he is not enough. As he is inadequate to face life's demands or to present an acceptable face to the world. He is unable to tolerate his own emotions without artificial supports. He must escape the painful experience of the void within through any activity that fills his mind with even temporary purpose, be it work, gambling, shopping, eating, or sexual seeking. In my first book, Scattered Minds, I depicted this perennial psychic hunger. The British psychiatrist R.D. Lang wrote somewhere that there are three things human beings are afraid of: death, other people, and their own minds. Terrified of my mind, I had always dreaded to spend a moment alone with it. There always had to be a book in my pocket as an emergency kit in case I was ever trapped waiting anywhere, even for 1 minute, be it a bank lineup or supermarket checkout counter. I was forever throwing my mind scraps to feed on, as to a ferocious and malevolent beast that would devour me the moment it was not chewing on something else. At that time, I ascribed that state of perpetual dissatisfaction to attention deficit disorder. Although a salient mental feature of ADD, the drive to escape the moment is a common, nearly universal human characteristic. In the addicted brain, it is magnified to the point of desperation. It becomes the overriding force in directing choices and behavior. "But I don't feel any desperation," some may say. "I just love whatever I'm doing so much that I never want to stop." Workaholics are prone to think that way, and I used to. "Where is all this pain and grief I'm supposed to feel in order to heal?" I once challenged a therapist. "Try as I may, I can't force myself to feel anything. Feelings either come or they don't." I was so busy stimulating and soothing myself with ceaseless activity, working overtime to keep my brain spinning and gorging it with mind candy, that I didn't leave even a small gap for any feeling to seep through. My workaholism and compact disc shopping have been only the most consistent forms of escape my mind chooses when it's uncomfortable. There have been other behaviors just as compulsive and just as impulsive. I see now that the underlying anxiety and sense of emptiness have been pervasive. Emotionally, they take the shape of chronic, low-grade depression and irritability. On the thought level, they manifest as cynicism, the negative side of the healthy skepticism and independent thinking I've always valued. Behaviorally, they mask themselves as hypomanic energy or as lethargy, as the constant hankering for activity or for oblivion. When the ordinary, everyday escape mechanisms fail to satisfy, I plunge into my overtly addictive patterns. If I had greater pain and fewer resources, if I had been less fortunate in the circumstances of my nurturing environment, I might well have been impelled to turn to drugs. Compassionate curiosity directed toward the self leads to the truth of things. Once I see my anxiety and recognize it for what it is, the need to escape dwindles. It is clear to me that the sense of threat and fear of abandonment that make up anxiety were, in my case, programmed in the Budapest ghetto in 1944. Why attempt to escape some old brain pattern laid down when I was a frightened infant during a terrible time in history? It's there, and the circuits in which its wordless stories are embedded are indelibly a part of my brain. It doesn't need to go away. Indeed, it won't go away, not completely. But I can transform my relationship to it, become more intimately related to it. I can even gain some mastery over it, which means noticing it without allowing it to control my moods or behaviors. Similarly, I don't have to take on the impossible task of erasing the addictive impulses that arose from early acquired brain patterns, but I can transform my relationship to them as well. Essential to any such transformations is a letting go of judgment and self-condemnation. Psychiatrist and psychoanalyst Anthony Storr has written about the value of allowing buried emotions to emerge without fear. When a person is encouraged to get in touch with and express his deepest feelings, in the secure knowledge that he will not be rejected, criticized, nor expected to be different, some kind of rearrangement or sorting out process often occurs within the mind, which brings with it a sense of peace, a sense that the depths of the well of truth have really been reached. What is the first step to take once self-compassion allows the truth to emerge? Inevitably, it's the step one taught by Alcoholics Anonymous and other 12-step programs. 12-step methods are not for everyone, and they may not be the only route out of addiction, but the principles on which they are based are common to any successful program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable, is the classic AA formulation. Mindful of the fundamental similarity of all addictions, one can broaden that to say, I admit I am powerless over my addiction process. That is, I fully acknowledge that my cravings and behaviors have been out of control and that my inability to regulate them has led to dysfunction and chaos in important areas of my life. I no longer deny their impact on myself or my coworkers or my loved ones, and I admit my failure to confront them honestly and consistently. A friend of mine, Anne, who is a longtime member of AA, cautions against my reformulation of the we admitted to I admit. The first word is plural for a reason, she says. If I'm an addict, and if I'm left alone to my own resources, then I'm pretty much lost. I have been reluctant to take this step until recently, despite the fact that I've not had a problem admitting and describing my addictive tendencies either in private or in public. The difficulty has been threefold. First, since I pride myself on a strong intellect, I've resisted accepting that I'm powerless over any mental process. On the contrary, it is in the nature of the ego to turn anything to its advantage. Even the public disclosure of my addictive patterns has served to reassure me of my sincerity and honesty and courage. Audiences greet such self-disclosure with nods, appreciative smiles, and applause. But real courage does not lie in speaking about addiction. It resides in actively doing something about it. And that, until very recently, I have not been prepared to take on. Second, in focusing on the most visible compulsive behaviors, such as CD shopping, book binging, or workaholism, I could still permit myself to ignore how addictive patterns have permeated much of my functioning. Narrowing it down to a few problematic issues has allowed me to deny that the addiction process shows up in numerous aspects of my daily existence. There are many things I do well and many tasks I accomplish, I could assure myself, so there is no cause for me to admit a loss of control. In other words, I have not wanted to accept that at times my life is made unmanageable by my own behaviors. In the absence of compassionate curiosity, any such admission brings up too much shame. Finally, whenever I have felt wooden or alienated in the intimate areas of life, I've seen myself as deprived, rather than owning the reality that I create the sense of deprivation internally. For example, I have blamed my wife, Ray, for not satisfying my expectations instead of taking responsibility for the burdens I impose on our relationship through poor self-regulation and lack of differentiation, my capacity to hold on to a sense of self while interacting with Ray and others. That leaves me free to use the addictions for self-soothing and to justify doing so by citing my unmet needs. In other words, the consequences of my own willful refusal to be a mature, self-regulating adult become my rationale for pursuing addictive behaviors. As I write about this, the image of a whirling puppy snapping at its own tail comes to mind. There is no moving forward without breaking through the wall of denial, or, in the case of such an obstinate and slippery mind as mine, breaking through several walls, whose existence I do not even want to acknowledge. Chapter 30. The Internal Climate. God does not change people's lot until they first change what's in their own hearts. The Quran, 13:11. No organism in nature is separate from the system in which it lives, functions, and dies, and no natural process can be understood in isolation from its physical and biological context. From an ecological perspective, the addiction process doesn't happen accidentally, nor is it pre-programmed by heredity. It is a product of development in a certain context, and it continues to be maintained by factors in the environment. The ecological view sees addiction as a changeable and evolving dynamic that expresses a lifelong interaction with a person's social and emotional surroundings and with his own internal psychological space. Healing, then, must take into account the internal psychological climate, the beliefs, memories, mind states, and emotions that feed addictive impulses and behaviors, as well as the external milieu. In an ecological framework, recovery from addiction does not mean a cure for a disease, but the creation of new resources, internal and external, that can support different, healthy ways of satisfying one's genuine needs. It also involves developing new brain circuits that can facilitate more adaptive responses and behaviors. At first sight, the task of a troubled mind transforming itself may seem hopelessly daunting. "What an abyss of uncertainty," wrote the novelist Marcel Proust, "whenever the mind feels overtaken by itself, when it, the seeker, is at the same time the dark region through which it must go seeking." Or, as a patient in Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz's obsessive-compulsive disorder clinic in Los Angeles said, "What we are looking for is what we are looking with." As these observations suggest, it would be impossible to recover from addiction if a person's mental life were determined purely by automatic brain functions and underground emotional dynamics. Powerful as those are, and decisive as they can be for many people in many circumstances, they are not the only actors on the scene. Fortunately for human beings, the mind is more than the workings of our automatic brain mechanisms, and it turns out, the brain itself can develop throughout a lifetime. Not only in childhood, but for our entire lives, our brains remain use-dependent. For example, a part of the hippocampus, a brain structure important for memory, has been shown to be much larger than average in London cabbies. The size increase was correlated with the number of years they'd spent navigating through the dense traffic of the British capital. In the words of neurologist and brain researcher Antonio Damasio, "The design of brain circuits continues to change. The circuits are not only receptive to the results of first experience, but are repeatedly pliable and modifiable by continued experience." So there are two ways of promoting healthy brain development, and both are essential to the healing of addiction: by changing the external environment, and by modifying the internal one. The mammalian brain appears to have the capacity to remain responsive to environmental enrichment well into advanced age, asserted Dr. Marion Diamond, a renowned brain researcher at the Department of Anatomy Physiology at Berkeley. In her laboratory, newborn to elderly rats were kept in varying degrees of social isolation, stimulation, and environmental and nutritional enrichment. Autopsies showed that the layers of the cortex in the brains of the environmentally favored rats were thicker, their nerve cells larger, their branching more elaborate, and their blood supply richer. Privileged rats well past midlife could still grow connecting branches almost twice as long as their standard cousins after only 30 days of differential treatment. Dr. Diamond reported these results in her book, Enriching Heredity: The Impact of the Environment on the Anatomy of the Brain. And, since then, in a non-academic book for the general public, Magic Trees of the Mind. "At any age studied," she wrote, "we have shown anatomical effects due to enrichment or impoverishment." Most encouraging were Dr. Diamond's findings that even the brains of animals deprived before birth or damaged in infancy were able to compensate through structural changes in response to enriched living conditions. Thus, she wrote, we must not give up on people who begin life under unfavorable conditions. Environmental enrichment has the potential to enhance their brain development too, depending on the degree or severity of the insult. Since Marion Diamond's pioneering studies, the power of an enriched environment to induce positive brain development has been demonstrated repeatedly. For example, rats in a superior housing situation gained new brain connections and as much as a 20% increase in the size of the cortex. In the words of the researchers, an extraordinary change. In humans, too, we can expect the adult brain to be beneficially influenced by the environment. The same has long been known to be true for almost any other organ or part of the body. Unused muscles atrophy, but if well exercised, they grow in size and strength. Blood supply to the heart is improved by exercise and healthy diet. Our lung capacity increases with aerobic training. Elderly people who remain physically and intellectually active suffer much less decline in their mental functioning than their more passive contemporaries. Contrary to dogma, the human brain does produce new nerve cells in adulthood, reported two neurobiologists in Scientific American in 1999. Early in life, the responsiveness of the human brain to changing conditions, known as neuroplasticity, is so great that infants who suffer damage to one side of their brain around the time of birth, even if they lose an entire hemisphere, may compensate for the deficit. The other half develops so that these children grow up to have nearly symmetrical facial movements and only a mild or moderate limp. With age, plasticity declines, but it is never completely lost. Neurological adaptability in adulthood may be seen in the recovery many people make from a stroke. In a cerebrovascular accident, or stroke, brain tissue is destroyed, usually due to bleeding. Although nerve cells that have died will not come back to life, often the patient will once more be able to use a limb that was paralyzed by the stroke. New circuits have taken over, and new connections have been made. In fact, this process has recently been harnessed in the rehabilitation of stroke victims, leading to remarkable advances. The work of Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz and his colleagues at UCLA has shown that in the brains of people with obsessive-compulsive disorder, new circuitry can be successfully established that overrides the ill-functioning circuits. Dr. Schwartz suggests, and I completely agree, that methods used at UCLA can be adapted to the healing of addictive compulsions. We will take a close look at them in the next chapter. Now there is no question, Dr. Schwartz writes, that the brain remodels itself throughout life, and that it retains the capacity to change itself as the result not only of passively experienced factors, such as enriched environments, but also of changes in the ways we behave and the ways we think. Nor is there any question that every treatment that exploits the power of the mind to change the brain involves arduous effort, by patients afflicted by stroke or depression, by Tourette or OCD, to improve both their functional capacity and their brain function. Arduous effort is also required on the part of any addict, all the more since her compulsions entice her to behaviors that, contrary to other distressing conditions, promise pleasure and reward. The mind activity that can physically rewire malfunctioning brain circuits and alter our dysfunctional emotional and cerebral responses is conscious mental effort, what Dr. Schwartz calls mental force. If changing external circumstances can improve brain physiology, so can mental effort. Intention and attention exert real physical effects on the brain, Dr. Schwartz explains. Not surprisingly, the brain area activated in studies looking at the effect of self-directed mental effort is the prefrontal cortex, the apex of the brain's emotional self-regulation system. It's also an area where, we have learned, the brains of addicts are impaired. The mental activity most critical to the development of emotional self-regulation has been called dispassionate self-observation by the authors of an important article on the interface of brain and mind, published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society, Biological Sciences, in 2005. The way in which a person directs their attention, i.e. mindfully or unmindfully, will, they write, affect both the experiential state of the person and the state of his/her brain. Mindful awareness involves directing our attention not only to the mental content of our thoughts, but also to the emotions and mind states that inform those thoughts. It is being aware of the processes of our minds, even as we work through its materials. Mindful awareness is the key to unlocking the automatic patterns that fetter the addicted brain and mind. The dominant emotions suffusing all addictive behavior are fear and resentment, an inseparable vaudeville team of unhappiness. One prompts and sets up the other, fear of the way things are and resentment that they are that way, fear of life and resentment that life is as difficult as it is, fear of unpleasant mind states and resentment that unpleasant moods and thoughts persist, fear that we'll never feel all right and resentment that we cannot feel the way we want to, fear of the present and the future, and resentment that we cannot control destiny. Addiction is running from reality, a patient of mine once said, the reality you have that something is stronger, something that's greater than you, instead of admitting it and saying that something scares me, this thing scares me, or I don't know how to do this, or I don't know how to live. Instead of just saying that, you do drugs. So you coexist with the people that are non-existent. People are just surviving but not living. As long as the effects of the addictive substance or behavior last, resentment and fear are temporarily suppressed, but afterwards, the emotions always rebound with greater force than before. It's an endless cycle because the addicted life will unfailingly generate new sources to feed the energy of anxiety and resentment. In such a state, the philosopher and writer Friedrich Nietzsche remarked, one cannot get rid of anything. One cannot get over anything. One cannot repel anything. Everything hurts. Men and things obtrude too closely. Experiences strike one too deeply. Memory becomes a festering wound. How to break the cycle? Everything has mind in the lead, has mind in the forefront, is made by the mind, the Buddha said. With our minds, we create the world we live in. The teaching of Buddhism is that the way to deal with the mind is not to attempt to change it, but to become an impartial, compassionate observer of it. Traditional Buddhist psychology did not have our scientific knowledge about the development of the brain, whose activity generates most of what we understand as mind. It did recognize, however, that once mind structures are in place, they determine our perceptions, behaviors, and experiences. By consciously observing the workings of our mind, we are able gradually to let go of its habitual, programmed interpretations and automatic reactions. Reflection on the addicted brain, not willful resistance to it, is the way to tame it. The unreflecting mind is a poor roof, Buddha taught. Passion, like the rain, floods the house. But if the roof is strong, there is shelter. Brain research is demonstrating that mindful awareness is able to release the grip of harmful thoughts and also to change positively the physiology of the brain circuits where those thoughts originate. The implications for the healing of addiction are far-reaching. We can distinguish between two kinds of mind function: awareness, the dispassionate observer, and the jumble of automatic processes, conscious, semi-conscious, and subconscious, that dictate our emotional states, thoughts, and much of our behavior. One of the first scientists to recognize this distinction was the great Canadian neurosurgeon Wilder Penfield. Although the content of consciousness depends in large measure on neuronal activity, awareness itself does not, Penfield wrote. To me, it seems more and more reasonable to suggest that the mind may be a distinct and different essence from the brain. The automatic mind, the reactive product of brain circuits, constantly interprets the present in the light of past conditioning. In its psychological responses, it has great difficulty telling past from present, especially whenever it is emotionally aroused. A trigger in the present will set off emotions that were programmed perhaps decades ago at a much more vulnerable time in the person's life. What seems like a reaction to some present circumstance is, in fact, a reliving of past emotional experience. This subtle but pervasive process in the body, brain, and nervous system has been called implicit memory, as compared to the explicit memory apparatus that recalls events, facts, and circumstances. According to the psychologist and memory researcher Daniel Schachter, implicit memory is active when people are influenced by past experience without any awareness that they are remembering. If we are unaware that something is influencing our behavior, there is little we can do to understand or counteract it. The subtle, virtually undetectable nature of implicit memory is one reason it can have powerful effects on our mental lives. Whenever a person overreacts, that is, reacts in a way that seems inappropriately exaggerated to the situation at hand, we can be sure that implicit memory is at work. The reaction is not to the irritant in the present, but to some buried hurt in the past. Many of us look back puzzled on some emotional explosion and ask ourselves, what the heck was that about? It was about implicit memory. We just didn't realize it at the time. The other mind entity is what we can call the impartial observer. This mind of present moment awareness stands outside the pre-programmed physiological determinants and is alive to the present. It works through the brain, but is not limited to the brain. It may be dormant in many of us, but it is never completely absent. It transcends the automatic functioning of past conditioned brain circuits. In the end, wrote Penfield, I conclude that there is no good evidence that the brain alone can carry out the work that the mind does. Knowing oneself comes from attending with compassionate curiosity to what is happening within. Methods for gaining self-knowledge and self-mastery through conscious awareness strengthen the mind's capacity to act as its own impartial observer. Among the simplest and most skillful of the meditative techniques taught in many spiritual traditions is the disciplined practice of what Buddhists call bare attention. Nietzsche called Buddha that profound physiologist, and his teachings less a religion than a kind of hygiene. When the Buddha seeks to liberate the soul from resentment, Nietzsche wrote, it is not morality that speaks thus. Thus speaks physiology. Many of our automatic brain processes have to do with either wanting something or not wanting something else, very much the way a small child's mental life functions. We are forever desiring and longing, or judging and rejecting. Mental hygiene consists of noticing the ebb and flow of all those automatic grasping or rejecting impulses without being hooked by them. Bare attention is directed not only toward what's happening on the outside, but also to what's taking place on the inside. Be at least as interested in your reactions as in the person or situation that triggers them, Eckhart Tolle advises. In a mindful state, one can choose to be aware of the ebb and flow of emotions and thought patterns instead of brooding on their content. Not, he did this to me and therefore I'm suffering, but I notice that feelings of resentment and a desire for vengeance keep flooding my mind. Although bare attention was developed as a meditative practice, its use is not limited to formal meditation. It is the conscious attending to what occurs in the mind as it takes in physical or emotional stimuli from within and outside the body. Bare attention is the clear and single-minded awareness of what actually happens to us and in us at the successive moments of perception, write the authors of the Philosophical Transactions article. It is called bare because it attends just to the bare facts of a perception as presented either through the five physical senses or through the mind, without reacting to them. The addict seldom questions the reality of the unpleasant mood or feeling she wants to escape. She rarely examines the perspective from which her mind experiences and understands the world around her, and from which she hears and sees the people in her life. She is in a constant state of reactivity, not to the world so much as to her own interpretations of it. The distressing internal state is not examined. The focus is entirely on the outside. What can I receive from the world that will make me feel okay, if only for a moment? Bare attention can show her that these moods and feelings have only the meaning and power that she gives them. Eventually, she will realize that there is nothing to run away from. Situations might need to be changed, but there is no internal hell that one must escape by dulling or stimulating the mind. Addicted people often say, "I don't know who I really am." If the addict has more than the usual difficulty in holding on to a healthy sense of self, it's because in the addicted brain, the reaction patterns, emotions, and thoughts that create a sense of self fluctuate so widely. Due to impaired regulation over easily triggered feelings of craving and distress, the addicted mind lacks consistency. The psychological oscillations and pendulum swings are greater than those that most people experience. Thought patterns and emotional states pursue each other with an exaggerated rapidity and across a broader range. It seems there is less to hold on to. In fact, the addictive behaviors and substances are one way of trying to impose some structure. Many addicts define themselves through their addictions and feel quite unmoored and lost without them. Substance-dependent people do this, but so do workaholics and other behavior addicts. They fear giving up their addiction not only because of the temporary relief it offers, but also because they just cannot conceive who they might be without it. Bare attention allows us to take an objective stand outside the ever-moving ebb and flow of thought, reaction, and emotion, and to reinforce the part of us that can observe, know, and decide consciously. It allows us to observe the many individual frames, as it were, that make up the self-created movies in our minds. The key to the transformational potential of bare attention lies in the deceptively simple injunction to separate out one's reactions from the core events themselves, writes psychiatrist and Buddhist meditation teacher Mark Epstein. Much of the time, it turns out, everyday minds are in a state of reactivity. We take this for granted. We do not question our automatic identifications with our reactions, and we experience ourselves at the mercy of an often hostile or frustrating outer world, or an overwhelming or frightening inner one. With bare attention, we move from this automatic identification with our fear or frustration to a vantage point from which the fear or frustration are attended to with the same dispassionate interest as anything else. There is enormous freedom to be gained from such a shift. Instead of running from difficult emotions or hanging on to enticing ones, the practitioner of bare attention becomes able to contain any reaction, making space for it, but not completely identifying with it. Given that addiction is all about running from difficult emotions or hanging on to enticing ones, bare attention has the potential to dissolve the very motivations that drive the addicted mind. The advice I will give in the next chapter about reducing stress by dealing openly with emotions may seem to conflict with the concept of bare attention, in which we notice the evanescent and shifting nature of emotions. In reality, they both come down to attending carefully to what is happening in our minds, neither suppressing our feelings nor allowing them to rule us. As we've already seen, painful early experiences program both the neurophysiology of addiction and the distressing psychological states that addiction promises to relieve. Yet human beings who are able to direct conscious attention toward their mental processes discover something surprising. It's not what happened in the past that creates our present misery, but the way we have allowed past events to define how we see and experience ourselves in the present. A person can survive being beaten, but cannot remain psychologically intact if he convinces himself that he was beaten because he is by nature blameworthy, or because the world by its very nature is cruel. A child can overcome sexual violation, but she will be debilitated if she thinks that she somehow either deserved the abuse or brought it upon herself. She also cannot function as a self-respecting adult if she comes to believe that she is lovable or acceptable only for her sexuality. A neglected child may be helpless, but the damage comes if he acquires the defining belief that helplessness is his real and permanent state in the world. The greatest damage done by neglect, trauma, or emotional loss is not the immediate pain they inflict, but the long-term distortions they induce in the way a developing child will continue to interpret the world and her situation in it. All too often, these ill-conditioned implicit beliefs become self-fulfilling prophecies in our lives. We create meanings from our unconscious interpretation of early events, and then we forge our present experiences from the meanings we've created. Unwittingly, we write the story of our future from narratives based on the past. Although my mother likely saved my life by sending me away from the dangers of the Budapest ghetto before my first birthday, I experienced the event the only way an infant could, as abandonment. It left me with a permanent core sense that I must never be emotionally open and vulnerable. When Ray, my wife, says no to me or behaves in a way that upsets me, my automatic belief is that I'm being rejected or abandoned by the woman whose love I need. And my mechanical reaction is to detach emotionally, to withdraw. This is a common response of young children who experience emotional or physical separation from their parents. Addiction confers invulnerability because it allows us to soothe vulnerable emotions like pain or fear or the aching for love with behaviors, objects, or substances whenever we choose. It's a way to avoid intimacy. Mindful awareness can bring into consciousness those hidden, past-based perspectives so that they no longer frame our worldview. Choice begins the moment you disidentify from the mind and its conditioned patterns, the moment you become present, writes Eckhart Tolle. Until you reach that point, you are unconscious. Once I notice my programmed defensive impulse to withdraw from intimacy and understand its source, I have some choice whether or not to act it out. With even a modicum of sanity, why would I? In present awareness, we are liberated from the past. Your worst enemy cannot hurt you as much as your own thoughts when you haven't mastered them, says the Buddha. But once mastered, no one can help you as much, not even your father and your mother. I don't propose meditation and mindfulness as panaceas. It is futile to dream of corralling a group of active cocaine addicts or alcoholics into a meditation class. To pursue such practices, one requires mental resources, a commitment to emotional clarity, and access to teaching, and some mental space in one's life. They are also difficult, especially at the beginning. But for people whose lives are blighted by addictions, without being totally gripped by them, these practices can help light the way to wholeness. When asked about my view of meditation, my stock answer has been, I have a profound relationship with meditation. I think about it every day. It's true. Every day for years, I've heard the call of contemplative solitude, and nearly every day, I've turned a deaf ear. I've run from mental discipline like Jonah escaping the call of God until he ends up in the putrid belly of the whale. My addiction-prone, ADD brain always wants to look to the outside to get away from itself. As a result, I tend to oscillate between excessive multitasking busyness and a proclivity for vegging out in ways that leave me non-rested and dissatisfied. Meditation, with its demand for stillness and self-observation, has not been an activity I've joyfully embraced. At a recent meditation retreat, however, I had a breakthrough. I realized that my expectations for meditation practice had been too harsh on myself. I wanted to be good at it. I wanted spiritually uplifting things to happen. I wanted deep insights to arise. I now know it's a gentle process. One doesn't have to be good at meditation, achieve anything, or look for any particular result. As with any skill, only practice leads to improvement, and improvement is not even the point. The only point is the practice. What I have found is that when I do practice meditation, I find more ease in my life. I'm calmer, more emotionally present, more compassionate to others, and far less reactive to external triggers. In other words, I'm more of a self-regulating adult and less prone to self-soothing, addictive behaviors. Mindfulness practice will not by itself cool the addiction-heated mind, but addicted or not, it is an invaluable adjunct to whatever else we do. It's a way of working with the most immediate environment, the internal one. Mindfulness changes the brain, psychiatrist and brain researcher Daniel Siegel points out. Why would the way you pay attention in the present moment change your brain? How we pay attention promotes neural plasticity, the change of neural connections in response to experience. Mindfulness can be practiced throughout the day, not only on the meditation cushion. There are many techniques for this, but they all come down to paying close attention to one's experience of each moment without seeking distraction. When I go for walks now, I no longer have earphones piping music into my head. I try to stay present to the physical, oral, and visual sensations I experience, as well as noticing my mental processes and reactions. Sometimes, I can keep this up for as long as 30 seconds at a time before my mind scurries off into la-la land. I call that progress. Chapter 31. The Four Steps Plus One. This chapter outlines a specific method that I view as promising for behavioral addictions. For example, shopping, gambling, and eating compulsions, or for anyone wishing to disengage from maladaptive habits of thinking or acting. Its other value is that it sheds further light on the nature of the addicted brain and mind. These steps are not a comprehensive treatment for addiction, but can serve as an adjunct to 12-step programs or to the approaches recommended in the preceding and following chapters. They will not work if done mechanically, but require regular practice with conscious awareness. The ability of conscious attention to transform the automatic mind and its physiological substrates in the brain has been successfully applied at UCLA to the treatment of obsessive-compulsive disorder. As we have noted, OCD has a similarity to addiction in the driven nature of its behaviors. They are both impulse control disorders. Deeper than that, they are both based in anxiety. The person with OCD believes that something catastrophic may happen if she doesn't perform a particular activity a precise number of times and in a particular way. The addict's behavior or substance use is also meant to calm anxiety, an unease about life itself, or about a sense of insufficient self. And, we recall, OCD and addiction seem to share the phenomenon Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz has described as brain lock, the stuck neurological gears that cause thought to be acted out before the action can be stopped, because the brain's transmission mechanism cannot be put into neutral. When the obsessive or addictive thought occurs, obsessive or addictive action follows. There are further parallels on the biochemical level, with disturbances in neurotransmitter systems involving serotonin, for example. The method Dr. Schwartz and his colleagues have developed applies conscious attention in a systematic, four-step fashion. On brain scans, they have shown that the locked circuitry of OCD undergoes a change after a relatively brief period of consistent and disciplined practice by obsessive-compulsive patients. The demonstrated brain lock opens up, and the person is freed from the nonsensical thoughts that formerly compelled her behavior. Can the same four steps be applied to addiction? I haven't worked extensively with addictions, Dr. Schwartz told me, but given that addiction also involves problems with intrusive urges and repetitive behaviors, there is good reason to think that the four steps could be useful in its treatment. The UCLA four-step method is detailed in Dr. Schwartz's first book, Brain Lock. This slim volume, meant for the general reader, deals with OCD, but it does contain the suggestion that its recommendations may also be used in conditions characterized by the addiction process, including overeating, sexual addiction, pathological gambling, and substance abuse. What follows then, with Dr. Schwartz's kind permission, is my adaptation of the four steps to the healing of addiction. There is no clinical evidence to support this specific application, but there are excellent theoretical grounds for anticipating its value. The method is consistent with traditional 12-step approaches, although it is not intended to replace them. Addiction physicians elsewhere have also expressed interest in adapting this technique to their work. If a personal testimony is of interest, I'm glad to offer one. It has made a difference for me. The program devised at the UCLA School of Medicine for the treatment of OCD is formally called the Four-Step Self-Treatment Method. Needless to say, it depends on a high level of motivation for its success. As I pointed out earlier, motivation is generally higher in the case of OCD, where, unlike in addiction, the patient's experience of her symptoms is intrinsically unpleasant. For the substance or behavior addict, there is at least an initial promise of delight that flows from the activation of the brain's incentive motivation and attachment reward circuits. The suffering is delayed rather than immediate. There is no bypassing the first step suggested at the end of the previous chapter. That is, before we can usefully apply UCLA's four steps, we have to take the first step of acknowledging the full impact of the addiction, and we have to resolve to confront its power over our mind. The four-step program is based on the perspective that makes the best sense of disorders like OCD and addiction, that they are rooted in malfunctioning brain circuits and in implicit stories and beliefs that do not match reality. That, as we have seen, is the core problem in addiction because the development of the brain and the mind was negatively affected by adverse early circumstances. The first two steps place the maladaptive behaviors in their proper context of brain dysfunction. The third directs the brain to a more positive focus. With the time and mental space granted by the first three, the fourth step then reminds the addict of what motivates her to get over her habit. To support that process, I've added a fifth step that I have found helpful. The four steps should be practiced daily at least once, but also whenever an addictive impulse pulls you so strongly that you are tempted to act it out. Find a place to sit and write, preferably a quiet place, but even a bus stop will do if that's where you happen to be when the addictive urge arises. You'll want to keep a journal of this process, so carrying a small notebook with you is an excellent aid. A warning about possible pitfalls. I have a tendency, typical in ADD, of beginning projects with enthusiasm and a sense of commitment, only to abandon them after some lapse or failure. I've tried that, I'll then say, but it doesn't work for me. That attitude is also typical of self-recovery practices in addiction, since, by definition, addiction is characterized by relapses. I have to get that there is no it to work or not work. It doesn't have to work. I am the one who has to work. And what is commitment? Commitment is sticking with something not because it works or because I enjoy it, but because I have an intention that overrides momentary feelings or opinions. So too with the four-step program. You don't have to feel or believe that it's working for you. You just have to do it, and to understand that if you have lapsed, it doesn't mean that you have failed. It's an opportunity to begin anew. Step 1. Relabel. In step 1, you label the addictive thought or urge exactly for what it is, not mistaking it for reality. I may feel, for example, that I must leave off whatever I'm doing right now and go to the classical music store. The feeling takes on the quality of a need, of an imperative that must immediately be satisfied. Another person will say that she needs to have a chocolate bar immediately or needs to do this or that, depending on the object of the addiction. When we relabel, we give up the language of need. I say to myself, I don't need to purchase anything now or to eat anything now. I'm only having an obsessive thought that I have such a need. It's not a real, objective need, but a false belief. I may have a feeling of urgency, but there is actually nothing urgent going on. Essential to the first step, as to all the steps, is conscious awareness. It is conscious intention and attention, not just rote repetition, that will result in beneficial changes to brain patterns, thoughts, and behaviors. Be fully aware of the sense of urgency that attends the impulse, and keep labeling it as a manifestation of addiction, rather than any reality that you must act upon. In relabeling, writes Dr. Schwartz, you bring into play the impartial spectator, a concept that Adam Smith used as the central feature of his book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments. He defined the impartial spectator as the capacity to stand outside yourself and watch yourself in action, which is essentially the same mental action as the ancient Buddhist concept of mindful awareness. The point of relabeling is not to make the addictive urge disappear. It's not going to, at least not for a long time, since it was wired into the brain long ago. It is strengthened every time you give into it, and every time you try to suppress it forcibly. The point is to observe it with conscious attention, without assigning the habitual meaning to it. It is no longer a need, only a dysfunctional thought. Rest assured, the urge will come back, and again you will relabel it with determination and mindful awareness. Conscious attention must be paid, Jeffrey Schwartz emphasizes. Therein lies the key. Physical changes in the brain depend for their creation on a mental state in the mind, the state called attention. Paying attention matters. Step 2. Reattribute. In reattribute, you learn to place the blame squarely on your brain. This is my brain sending me a false message. This step is designed to assign the relabeled addictive urge to its proper source. In step 1, you recognized that the compulsion to engage in the addictive behavior does not express a real need or anything that must happen. It's only a belief. In step 2, you state very clearly where that urge originated, in neurological circuits that were programmed into your brain long ago when you were a child. It represents a dopamine or endorphin hunger on the part of brain systems that, early in your life, lacked the necessary conditions for their full development. It also represents emotional needs that went unsatisfied. Reattribution is directly linked with compassionate curiosity toward the self. Instead of blaming yourself for having addictive thoughts or desires, you calmly ask why these desires have exercised such a powerful hold over you. Because they are deeply ingrained in my brain, and because they are easily triggered whenever I'm stressed, or fatigued, or unhappy, or bored. The addictive compulsion says nothing about you as a person. It is not a moral failure or a character weakness. It is just the effect of circumstances over which you had no control. What you do have some control over is how you respond to the compulsion in the present. You were not responsible for the stressful circumstances that shaped your brain and worldview, but you can take responsibility now. Reattribution helps you put the addictive drive into perspective. It's no more significant than, say, a momentary ringing in your ear. Just as there is no bell that causes the ringing, so there is no real need that the addictive urge will satisfy. It is only a thought, an attitude, a belief, a feeling arising from an automatic brain mechanism. You can observe it consciously, with attention, and you can let it go. There are better sources of dopamine or endorphins in the world, and more satisfying ways to have your needs for vitality and intimacy met. Once more, don't allow yourself to be frustrated when what you have let go returns. It will, probably soon. When it does, you will relabel it and reattribute it. Hello, old brain circuits, you say. I see you're still active. Well, so am I. If you change how you respond to those old circuits, you will eventually weaken them. They will persist for a long time, perhaps even all your life, but only as shadows of themselves. They will no longer have the weight, the gravitational pull, or the appeal they once boasted. You will no longer be their marionette. Step 3. Refocus. In the refocus step, you buy yourself time. Although the compulsion to open the bag of cookies, or turn on the TV, or drive to the store or the casino is powerful, its shelf life is not permanent. Being a mind phantom, it will pass, and you have to give it time to pass. The key principle here, as Dr. Schwartz points out, is this. It's not how you feel that counts. It's what you do. Rather than engage in the addictive activity, find something else to do. Your initial goal is modest. Buy yourself just 15 minutes. Choose something that you enjoy and that will keep you active, preferably something healthy and creative, but anything that will please you without causing greater harm. Instead of giving in to the siren call of the addiction, go for a walk. If you need to drive to the casino, turn on the TV. If you need to watch television, put on some music. If you need to buy music, get on your exercise bike. Whatever gets you through the night, or at least through the next 15 minutes. Early in therapy, advises Jeffrey Schwartz, physical activity seems to be especially helpful. But the important thing is that whatever activity you choose, it must be something you enjoy doing. The purpose of refocus is to teach your brain that it doesn't have to obey the addictive call. It can exercise the free won't. It can choose something else. Perhaps in the beginning you can't even hold out for 15 minutes. Fine, make it 5 and record it in a journal as a success. Next time, try for 6 minutes or 16. This is not a 100-meter dash, but a solo marathon you are training for. Successes will come in increments. As you perform the alternative activity, stay aware of what you are doing. You are doing something difficult. No matter how simple it may seem to others, who do not have to live with your particular brain, you know that holding out for even a short period of time is an achievement. You are teaching your old brain new tricks. Unlike the case with old dogs, no one can tell you it can't be done. Step 4. Revalue. This step should really be called devalue. Its purpose is to help you drive into your own thick skull just what has been the real impact of the addictive urge in your life. Disaster. You know this already, and that is why you are engaged in these 4 steps. It's because of the negative impact that you've taken yourself by the scruff of the neck and delayed acting on the impulse while you've relabeled and reattributed it, and while you have refocused on some healthier activity. In this revalue step, you will remind yourself why you've gone to all this trouble. The more clearly you see how things are, the more liberated you will be. We know that the addicted brain assigns a falsely high value to the addictive object, substance, or behavior, the process called salience attribution. The addicted mind has been fooled into making the object of your addiction the highest priority. Addiction has moved in and taken over your attachment reward and incentive motivation circuits. Where love and vitality should be, addiction roosts. The distorted brain circuits, including the orbitofrontal cortex, are making you believe that experiences that can come authentically only from genuine intimacy, creativity, or honest endeavor will be yours for the taking through addiction. In the revalue step, you devalue the false gold. You assign to it its proper worth, less than nothing. What has this addictive urge done for me, you will ask? It has caused me to spend money heedlessly, or to stuff myself when I wasn't hungry, or to be absent from the ones I love, or to expend my energies on activities I later regretted. It has wasted my time. It has led me to lie and to cheat and to pretend, first to myself and then to everyone close to me. It has left me feeling ashamed and isolated. It promised joy and delivered bitterness. Such has been its real value to me. Such has been the effect of my allowing some disordered brain circuits to run my life. The real value of my addictive compulsion has been that it has caused me to betray my true values and disregard my true goals. Be conscious as you write out this 4th step, and do write it out, several times a day if necessary. Be specific. What has been the value of the urge in your relationship with your wife, your husband, your partner, your best friend, your children, your boss, your employees, your coworkers? What happened yesterday when you allowed the urge to rule you? What happened last week? What will happen today? Pay close attention to what you feel when you recall these events, and when you foresee what's ahead if you persist in permitting the compulsion to overpower you. Be aware. That awareness will be your guardian. Do all this without judging yourself. You are gathering information, not conducting a criminal trial against yourself. Jesus said, "If you bring forth what is within you, what you have will save you." That is true in so many ways. Within you is knowledge of the real value of the impulses you have obeyed until now. To quote and paraphrase Dr. Schwartz, the more consciously and actively you come to revalue the addictive drive in light of its pernicious influence on your life, the more quickly and smoothly you can perform the relabel, reattribute, and refocus steps, and the more steadily your brain's automatic transmission function returns. Revaluing helps you shift the behavioral gears. Dr. Schwartz introduces what he calls the two A's, anticipate and accept. To anticipate is to know that the compulsive drive to engage in addictive behavior will return. There is no final victory. Every moment